Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with David Kirby, whose last book, Evidence of Harm, talked about autism and vaccines and more. But we're not going there today. Maybe we'll bring him back for that another day, because it's an issue that is popping all over the map. We're talking about his latest book called Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. He writes for Huffington Post and does a great deal of writing, lives in New York, in Brooklyn. And if you want to go to our webpage, steinershow.org, you can link on to animalfactory.com, animalfactorybook.com, which is his website, and you can look at that as we're talking. And David Kirby, welcome to Baltimore, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
I said, you understand, you were here last night talking to the Center for a Livable Future.
Correct. Over at Johns Hopkins, had a nice crowd show up, students, faculty members of the public. They do great work. I was telling them, I hope I didn't insult them, but how the name of their school is so wonderful, but it's something that you would just expect. You would expect the future to be livable. But unfortunately, we have to work at it. It's not going to happen automatically. The way we're raising the majority of our livestock and poultry in this country, it affects that livability, certainly for the people who live nearby that. So it was a good place to speak.
It's a very tough subject, because I think the way you address it in your book and in the other things I've seen you write, you're not a purist about this, about your own life and what you eat.
Correct.
So you're not preaching to folks about, you know, you have to go to Whole Foods and take your entire paycheck and figure out how you can have a meal.
It's a bit of a self-defensive method. I mean, this way people can't tell me to practice what I preach, because I'm not preaching. But I do give advice, and I think people should take responsibility for the food they eat, and most importantly, inform themselves. At least know before you buy. Make an informed choice, just like you would when you buy a car or a child safety seat or medicine for your kid. Know where your food comes from. If you're okay with it, or if you can't afford sustainably, that's my point. I mean, I understand why people make the choices they do. So you can make your choices, but you have to make them after you've educated yourself.
So let me come back a little bit in how you approach the subject in your book. First of all, I mean, how many years did you spend writing this book?
2 years researching and a year writing.
So you spent a lot of time, as we would say, as you write in your book, to use the word poo, which is a word we can use on the air.
Yeah, I use other words sparingly.
Sparingly. So when you think about spending a life, 4 years, contemplating waste, mm-hmm. animal waste,
yeah,
you've got your foot in it, in a literal sense, right?
Yeah, and your nostrils and your throat.
Because you smell the stuff you're talking about.
You live and breathe it. Quite literally, I live this story. And I went to 20 different states, talked to people who live near these factory farms, concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. And, of course, the number one complaint is the odor. The number two complaint is the flies. Usually the number three complaint is contamination of local water. But the smell is horrible. And in some places, particularly out west, the big dairies where they have these cows out on these open lots in the summertime, the manure just bakes in the sun, and the cows come and trample it and crumble it up into dust, and then the wind comes and kicks it up. I mean, I've seen brown fog in the valley in Yakima where the cars had to turn on their headlights to get through it. And I would come
home from... Yakima was a beautiful valley in Washington State.
It is still a beautiful valley.
Yakima Valley. Not was. It is still a beautiful valley.
Although the water is being contaminated up there, and the EPA is there right now taking samples. The people who have to live and breathe these gases, particulate matter, sometimes they're breathing in bacteria that's resistant to antibiotics. I mean, this has all been proven scientifically, that these things emit things into the air that are harmful.
So when you did this, I have to ask this other quick question here. I digress on this too much, but Orwell's book Animal Farm is a book that many of us grew up with and just love. The newest book is called Animal Factory. Do you have is there a sense of that in this book for you, and a sense of Orwell in your book?
I think it's actually a little bit more Aldous Huxley, Brave New World.
Another one of my favorites.
With all due respect to Mr. Orwell. No, obviously it's a play on that title. I mean, I'm not going to – I mean, it was a convenient fact that it happened to sound
great
like
title.
Another. Thank you. There's actually an old movie with Bruce Willis with that title as well. It's because, and in the very beginning of the book, I list the definition of a farm and the definition of a factory. And
right.
When you read those, that really does sum up what we're talking about here.
Let's read it to the people, so you can come back to what you were saying.
Sure.
The definition is a farm, a noun, a tract of land, usually with a house, barn, silo, etc., in which crops and often livestock are raised for livelihood. Factory, noun, a building or group of buildings with facilities to manufacture a uniform product without concern for individuality.
Mm-hmm. The key words there on the farm side are house. The people live on site, and that's how they make their living off the land. And crops, plural, and livestock. In other words, it's not monoculture. It's a family farm. It's diversified. There's fruits. There's vegetables. There's different types of animals, typically, on a sustainable family farm. The key word, I think, on the other side is uniform. And when they produce 10,000 pigs at a time, they're producing it for these huge, giant slaughterhouses that run the whole industry. Those pigs are uniform. They have the exact half inch of fat on their back. They have the exact weight, the exact size, exact meat texture, which I find to be a little less flavorful than, say, a heritage bred Berkshire pork. It's all part of the big machine, you know. So it is industrial production. There's no question.
And I'm going to get to this, the question of this machine, because the way you describe and how it's described in your book, how these animals live and why they're bred this way and how they're bred this way is pretty frightening when you think about it. You may never eat meat again if you actually walked into one of those factory farms.
You would eat meat that was grown sustainably. I stayed on pig farms in the Midwest where the pigs were right outside the door, and I would go out and see them, and they were cute, and they were running around playing. And then at dinner, we would have pork chops, and I didn't want to be rude, and I ate the pork chops, and I was fine with it because I knew that. But right across the street was a hog factory where at night they would turn off the lights and leave because nobody lived there, and the pigs would start attacking each other, and the voices, the screaming, the noises, I meant to say, I will never, ever forget that sound.
It sounded like a pig screaming. It's like humans crying in the dark.
It sounded like children.
It does. Actually. Pig screaming is just a scary sound.
It's very, very unnerving. I don't want to paint the entire agriculture community with a single brush. And some of these CAFOs are well run, if you want to put it that way. Certainly the people I met and that let me into their farms were concerned about the environment. They were concerned about their animals. Those animals seem to be treated well, but they are still part of this much larger corporate structure. The problem is not everybody operates to those standards, and they're still basically on the honor system. They complain that they're too regulated and that the EPA is after them, but the fact is they basically report to the state how much manure they're spreading on the land, and nobody checks their homework. So we need a lot more enforcement to make these things pollute less.
So let's talk a bit about how you approach this and how you do this. I'm going to come back to some of the issues you just raised about the complexities. Later on, I want to talk about the complexities of industrial farming and how some people who believe in sustainability, and I'm one of those, and try to buy my food from sustainable places, but how difficult it would be to transform our system into that place. And we need to talk about that. I think reality checks are important in what we don't like and what we want to see.
I couldn't agree more.
But you approach this story really building it around several families and dozens of other people come into the picture.
Yes.
You build it around Karen Hudson, Rick Dove, who you start with, and Helen Bauer.
Helen Redoubt.
Redoubt, I mean, who was Bauer.
Yes, yes, very good. You did read this book.
Right. And but other people come into this book.
Uh-huh.
So talk about that. I want to talk about these individuals, each one of them.
Sure.
And what they faced.
Sure.
But I'm also curious, as a writer, your approach to this, because you, as I said to you before we went on to the air, was that one thing that was interesting about this book is that it wasn't just a boring book full of technical details about farming. You actually looked at people, described how they looked, their inner workings, who they were. This is as much about factory farming and sustainable farming as it is about human beings who live in this world.
Mm-hmm. It comes down to a very simple phrase, maybe two phrases. One is people like to read about people. Mm-hmm. It's just a simple fact. the one, second one, I think, comes from my old editor, who I got my start in journalism with a long time ago, the great Pete Hamill, who told me a good story tells itself. If you got one, get out of the way. And these people have terrific stories. I mean, they're very, very compelling stories. My agent, Todd Schuster in New York, told me when I set out to write my first book, which was like this book, controversial, complicated, deals with a lot of science, a lot of law, a lot of legislation. The legislation is the driest, hardest, most awful part of all of it, believe it or not. To wrap your head around, and it's very, very complicated, and to just set out to write a book like that, you're right. You're not considering your reader. You're putting your reader through homework and you know, schoolwork.
And we hated that.
Everybody hates that. I wouldn't read a book. So Todd said, find people, real people that this happened to, and tell their story, and tell this through their story. And it worked so well with the first book, I just had no question that that was how I was going to write my second book. The problem is I just found so many people.
You did.
And I feel bad because initially I think I had about 8 main characters, like a great Russian novel. And my editor and my agent made me whittle it down. I got down to 5, and then it was 4. If they kept saying 3. 3 is good. 3. So I really had to focus on these 3 main stories. But
the others, they touch the others. Did you want to become main
characters? We visit with a lot of these other
people. There's a lot of people who are part of this.
Including
the Trevinos and all the rest, they touch and come into.
And Carol Morrison here in Delmarva, who's a chicken farmer who got out of the business.
Right.
Because she hated contracting for the big guys. But just to finish the question and the point, because you know, for all you nonfiction authors out there, and I'm not the first person to do this, obviously. The Insider is a very good model. There's other very good models of this way of nonfiction, you know, novelistic type approach where you do character development and character arc. You keep the reader that way, but then between the great passages, you spoon feed or really you force feed them the science and the law and all the stuff that people wouldn't pick up a book to read. But we're learning that stuff. When Karen goes to a conference on manure, you know, who would go to a manure management conference? You're ready. You can hear the eyes glazing over. But she goes, and she learns stuff that's relevant to her situation, and we can then put that together, and it makes it very real world. And we don't feel like we're in school.
No, and exactly right. I mean, that's one of the reasons I told you when I started this book. I said, well, it's huge. But then you get into it, and you really can't stop reading it because you really want to know what happens to these people in the world that they live in. Let's go through your 3 main characters.
Sure.
And talk a bit about where they lived and what they faced. Let's talk with Rick Dove, who the river keeper on the Neuse River, who actually retired Marine, grew up in Dundalk, here in Maryland.
Yep.
Tell us about where what the Neuse River was, why he was there, and how he got into the world he became.
Sure. He was a Marine. He was still a Marine, and he was a JAG, actually, a prosecutor. And he was transferred to Camp Lejeune. And so he lived there in North Carolina with his family, bought a house on the Neuse River outside of New Bern, very wide.
N-E-U-S-E is spelled, right?
N-E-U-S-E, correct. Correct. And he always just really wanted to fish. And he finally retired from the Marines, got a boat, grabbed his son, went out on the river. And for a couple of years, really good years, they had amazing success. And they opened a fishing business, and they opened a shop, and they would sell their fish to the local people. But then one day, the fish started dying in great numbers. They also started appearing with these red sores on their flanks. Very mysterious, awful. And then they would go into this death spiral and die by the millions and millions. Of course, the stench and the fish on the beach with this. And he just sat there and watched his paradise get ruined and had to close the fishing business, refused to catch or sell things that he wouldn't eat himself. And, of course, the sores started appearing on him and his son. They and other fishermen started becoming very disoriented out on the water. Anyway, Rick eventually tracked that to a dinoflagellate, a protozoan called Fisteria,
which we had an outbreak
here
in Maryland, here.
Yes,
terrible.
He did at the exact same time in Chesapeake. And he took it upon himself to figure out what was putting the nutrients into the water to make these outbursts, both the Fisteria and the algae blooms. One day he wakes up and the river was the color of orange juice.
Oh, right.
And it's quite, right. I saw the video of that, and it really was like Orange Julius out in the bay. So that's Rick's story, and he eventually became the riverkeeper, and now he works for Waterkeeper. And I'll be down there next week with the Neuse River Foundation in both New Bern, and I'm going up to Raleigh-Durham for some events.
For events with these riverkeepers and the...
Yes, and other speeches and book signings.
And, I mean, when you wrote about... When you wrote about what happened to the Manhattan, the fish, the Manhattan, who came in droves, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands, millions of fish, and all of a sudden they weren't there, they were dead, they never made it back to the ocean to procreate and come back and
correct.
And the rest. You also talked about this fisteria in a way that I found very creative in a different way of approaching it, about its ability to be this algae that just lives on a rock, peel like algae, and then come to life as a single-celled organism and kill a fish and attack human blood systems by leeching onto us if we're in the water. I mean, it's like a horror movie.
It is. They call it the cell from hell.
The cell from hell, right.
There
right,
was a book written right. about 10 years ago called And the Waters Turned to Blood that if anybody's interested in this particular area, they should read it. It has about 19 different stages to its life cycle, and it normally lays dormant at the bottom of the river as in a cyst-like state, and it's a plant. And yet, when it comes alive, it can actually self-propel, and it takes on animal-like characteristics, and it emits a toxin. The toxin stuns the fish, but it also will get up into the air, and that's where the fishermen breathe it in, et cetera, before it attacks the fish. Now, it has been linked to rising nutrients in the river, and it's important to point out that agriculture is not the only source of those nutrients. They come from wastewater plants, just like here in the Chesapeake Bay. But agriculture is a major source of these nutrients, and it's the most unregulated source.
And then you have Karen Hudson, Elmwood, Illinois.
Karen is a farm wife and former school teacher in a little tiny town where they still go out on summer nights and hear the band play in the band shell with the fireflies.
She's one who fell in love when she was a teenager and got married to the guy when she was seven. He was a year younger, and they remained together forever and all these kids. Right?
That's correct.
I love that story.
It's a great story. He's got a great name, Rocky Hudson.
Rocky Hudson, right.
And of course, there's a Gary Grant from North Carolina as well. So I got my movie stars covered. They're wonderful people. Talk about just sort of bedrock American farmers. His family, his German immigrant stock, they've been there since the 1800s on that property. He grows soybeans and corn. They're no-till farmers, so they're very environmentally aware. That means you don't plow under the topsoil each year so it blows away. And you do it so it doesn't blow away.
Right.
And this dairy, their neighbor, announced one day to the town that he was going to bring in. First it was going to be a pig farm, and then he switched to dairy. I think it was 7,000 cows. No, excuse me. The original pig farm would have been 7,000 pigs. I think it was 1,200 cows, which is still a massive amount. It was the largest dairy in Illinois at the time. And she begged him not to do it, and he did it anyway. And she was so concerned about the impact it was going to have on her community that she formed a group called Families Against Rural Messes.
Farm,
which that got my attention. I think that's a great name. And literally story of David and Goliath grassroots organizing from the ground up, and is now a national, all three of these people are nationally respected activists. That dairy, she predicted that terrible things would happen, and this guy who was basically a hobby farmer, and he worked for the Caterpillar Company in Peoria. Elmwood is just outside of Peoria. And he decided he wanted to run a dairy, and they all said, you don't know what you're doing, this is not going to work. And sure enough, one winter, a few years later, the rain and snow just kept coming and coming and coming. And his lagoon, his waste lagoon, where they liquefy this waste and keep in these giant open cesspools.
Cattle poo.
Yes.
Cattle,
we're
right.
Getting closer and closer and closer to the rim. And he panicked because it was going to burst. And he took some hoses and he pumped it about a mile away to a ravine that was blocked off with an earthen berm, and he pumped about 5 million gallons of waste into that ravine. But the berm broke, and all that water went into Kickapoo Creek, which empties into the Illinois River, right near where Peoria gets all of its drinking water. Of course, the Illinois River empties into the Mississippi River, and one can imagine that those nutrients, some of them, eventually made their way down to the Gulf of Mexico, where we now have the largest dead zone in the world, the size of New Jersey in the summertime. So you can see how just one spill in one little farm can contribute to an ecological disaster 700 miles to the south. It went on for days and days. It was just a horrible, horrible spill and mess, and Karen became even more involved after that point, and farm became very prominent in Illinois, and then she joined up with some of the, in the middle of the book, there's only two parts to the book. The first part is about these three characters and their individual stories, and they kind of sort of hear about each other and talk to each other on the internet, start meeting each other at conferences, and then we get to the second half of the book, which is called Going National. That's where they really do forge these very strong national alliances.
So let's get there and talk about Helen Reddow in Yakima Valley.
Helen is the toughest grandmother you're ever going to meet. I mean, she's a sweet woman, but she takes no guff from anybody. She is a cherry farmer. Her husband, Don, died a few years ago out working in the groves that he loved so much. It's a very sad story, but she carries on. She's was a reluctant warrior. She, at one point, when this first started happening, she thought, what happened was she was in Yakima Valley, which is a beautiful agricultural community, and these large dairies started coming up from California with, again, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 cows out on these open lots. And almost immediately, the air pollution started, the water pollution started. Helen woke up one summer night, and her entire house was filled with the smell of cow poop. And she ran around trying to shut all the windows. But, of course, and I've heard this story a million times, if you don't do it in time, you shut the stink inside the house. Mm-hmm. And you're just, you can imagine how crazy that makes people. She was spraying cheap perfume all over the place just to try to get back to sleep. And but she took pictures and she went to government agencies and she just tried everything she could. She tried the media and she wasn't getting anywhere. And she one night she just went out and burned all her papers. She said, I'm through. But I think she just loves her valley too much. And other people were getting involved in the fight and she then rejoined them. And they formed a group called CARE. And they got in touch with an environmental law firm that agreed to take on their case pro bono. And using the Clean Water Act, which most people don't know, average citizens can sue polluters under the Clean Water Act and take them to federal court. So they threatened to sue. They sent notices around to 10 of the big dairies, biggest dairies in the valley. And eventually most of them settled. But one guy, Henry Bosma, he refused to settle. They took him to court. And in the discovery process, Charlie Tebbett, who's a lawyer, I describe it, for years and years and years, the intransigence of this guy, when the state agencies would come out and slap him with fines and tell him to get a permit and, you know, everything, and he would just tell them to go to hell. At one point, he threatened to sic his Dobermans on them if they came back. So it's an amazing story of, and that's what I'm saying, not all farmers are alike, but this guy was particularly egregious, and he went to court and he lost big time, and he had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars paying for water well testing up in the valley.
And a lot of what you write about are the interactions between these farmers and their neighbors, and when these neighbors try to confront and talk to the industrial farmers who they live next to and try to be civil and quickly find out they can't be civil.
Some are more civil than others.
Some are more civil than others.
But there's always discord and divides communities.
And one of there are a couple of things I want to describe a bit in this conversation. And one of the thread that runs through it, whether it's Karen Hudson, Rick Dove, Helen Reddow, all the other people that you write about in this book, the African American farmers in North Carolina, the mm-hmm. Trevinos in Yakima Valley.
A woman having cancer treatment while they're spraying animal waste on
that
her.
That was just heartbreaking. They said, we just move out. They tell her, and we'll go move out of your house. And
they said, we'll put a red flag up the flagpole when we're spraying.
And then you can leave for a while.
And you can leave for a couple of days. And she was undergoing chemotherapy.
A couple of things hit me here. One is, and talk about this a bit, and then I'm going to talk about the conditions on the farms themselves, but that what hit me on these people is that they were all conservative, relatively conservative people, like a lot of rural people are, probably voted Republican, most of them, the way you describe them. And the frustration and what happened to them all as they confronted power, a power they had no idea even existed, that had that kind of power. They could, and they thought they were living in a democracy where they could just, you know, in a Norman Rockwellian way.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Smith.
Yes. Yep. I mean, that was what really, it was like this line that attached them all in their individual stories about what they confronted.
Yeah. You know, it's the same theme in my first book, unfortunately, and that's still playing out, and those people are still fighting powerful interests.
In the autism world. Sure. World of autism.
Yeah. No, I think it was quite an education for them. There is one Democrat in my cast of characters, Chris Peterson.
I want to talk about
from
him.
Iowa.
I have him in my notes. Yes,
he
wasn't he in a film as well? Was he in one of those films about the farm? Anyway, that's not important. But
I'm not sure.
We'll come back to that.
But everybody else was either registered Republican or definitely Republican voting and leaning. Rick, in 2004, made a MoveOn.org commercial, Republicans for Kerry, and talked about this very issue. And how he thought the government was there. You know, he and his son went fishing. They got sick. They turned to the government. George W. Bush did nothing. And he was disgusted by it. And it was a real eye-opening wake-up call. You know, it's not Teddy Roosevelt's Republican Party anymore. You know, conservatives used to conserve. And really,
right.
You know,
right.
That included the environment. So... And I think that's what makes them even more valid spokespeople for what they're doing. They get branded as anti-farming, and yet they're farmers. Karen and Helen are farmers. Rick's a fisherman. But, it's so funny. I get branded for being anti-vaccine because I talk or ask questions about vaccine safety. I'm not anti-vaccine. I think parents should vaccinate their kids. I have some questions, you know, and maybe some kids can't handle the thing. So when you start asking questions about the way our vaccines are produced, you get labeled anti-vaccine. When they start asking questions about where their food is produced, they get labeled anti-agriculture, even though they're farmers. And think about that term, you're anti-agriculture. Well, that means you're anti-food, right?
Right.
What are you supposed to eat? Rocks fried in mineral oil? It's impossible to be anti-agriculture. It's just crazy.
So, but what really hit me though about these is that we talked about this before we went on the air. This whole idea about trying to find a middle ground is not always a middle ground, but there's a different ground. And what these people, what united them was almost this hard bell going off in their heads that they believed that they could actually stop these factory farms. They could do something that was better for themselves and their community. They could get this cleaned up. And they found that they ran up against a political, economic brick wall.
Yes.
All of them ran up into the same brick wall. To the extent that you have this one guy in your book, what's his name? Wendell Murphy.
Sure.
Who was in two of the stories.
Yeah.
You know, and in his investments.
Murphy Farms invaded Illinois.
And, right, it started in
North
Carolina.
North Carolina, correct.
So.
Where he was a state legislator writing laws to benefit the pork industry even as he was developing his own pork empire, and it was perfectly legal.
So, talk about how you felt, what these people felt, and what they said to you about, and how you saw them transform and change
in terms
of what how they viewed society. I was telling you I interviewed these people the other night just about their world when Exxon let this water spill into the aquifer and then denied it was happening, and they had to take Exxon to court and poisoning their wells. Mm-hmm. I mean. Regular people get shocked by this, and then something happens.
Yeah. It's a multi-step process. I think at first they feel shocked that Helen Radout fully expected. First, she expected we'll go talk to the dairymen, right? And they'll mend their ways.
Right.
They'll understand it. They're new to Washington. We'll explain.
We're all farmers. We'll understand.
We're all
this.
Farmers. We'll tell them how we do things up
right.
here. And the guy told them, my poo doesn't stink. But, of course,
right.
he used a different word.
The S word, as we once got it. Yes.
S rhymes with hit. Can you say
that? Yeah. S rhymes with hit. You can say it, yes.
Say it real fast.
No, don't do that.
But that's what he said.
Right.
And that's not a very neighborly thing to say. He said, if you don't like it, you can move. So then they took pictures. They took them to the local authorities. And still nothing. So I think Helen was shocked. Rick couldn't believe. The state of North Carolina couldn't even tell him, wouldn't tell him where the pig farms were located or how many there were. That was kept by the Department of Ag. And he wasn't given – and here are the chicken farms in Maryland, I believe. It's the same thing.
Same
it's
thing.
Like it's a state secret. So I think there was shock at first. Then I think there was naivete, the self-recrimination. God, how could I be so stupid? I was really naive to think that. And then, of course, immense anger. Anger that instead of lashing out, they channeled into a defensive posture, really. You know, offense is the best defense. But in Yakima Valley, they did it by suing.
Mm-hmm.
In North Carolina, they did it by suing and through political action and working with the waterkeepers and raising awareness. And in Illinois, they did it through county ordinances and through just working with the media and raising public opinion. And their victories are small and spaced out. They don't happen every day, but they're there. And they have made a difference.
I'm going to take a short break. I'm going to come back. I'm going to talk about the victories and what they organized, President Obama, and describe more about how animals actually live on these farms. A little description of that to
sure.
give you a sense of this as well.
Sure.
We're talking with David Kirby. His book is Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. It's a story not just for those who live in the country, but all of us to think about where all this comes from. And I think this conversation will be broadening in America over the next decade. We'll be right back. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. We're still with David Kirby. He wrote the book Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. What happened to these people and where this goes is kind of really important. Rick Dove, who I like all these people. They're really interesting people. Rick Dove said that Mother Nature is taking control. I remember it in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you wrote, I forget who did it now, there's so much in here, but pigs are nature's mixing bowls for interspecies infection.
Yes.
You wrote that. I think that was your line, right?
Correct.
Right.
I actually plagiarized myself from the Huffington Post. I don't know if that's against the law.
That's okay. But talk about what that means. I mean,
sure.
Expand on that.
Sure. Well, and just to get back to Rick's point, and that is, you know, where are we going with all this? And we will talk about Obama, I hope, because
yes,
a lot of this has to do with public policy and what the government's going to do and what consumers are going to do and what's going to happen in the courts. But as Rick says, you know, you can shop sustainably all you like. You can litigate until the cows come home. You can go to Washington and protest and get laws changed. But legislation and litigation isn't going to solve the problem. It's possible that it's Mother Nature who's going to have the last word here. Forget the laws of humans. It's the laws of nature that are being violated. These animals were not designed to live by the hundreds and thousands crammed together into confinements without access to pasture, sunlight, fresh air, exercise, the ability to extend their limbs, the ability to socialize, to establish a pecking order, to mate, quite frankly, to nest, to forage, all the things that animals are genetically programmed to do, they're being denied in these confinements. And that creates stress, and stress leads to disease because immunity starts to break down. And sometimes they have to keep these pigs alive on drugs, mm-hmm. on low-dose antibiotics just to keep disease at bay. And and Rick's point is, if you look at MRSA, if you look at mad cow disease, BSE, if you look at swine flu, these are warning signs. Nature's telling us, don't do this. It will come back to bite you. We've had a lot of warning signs so far. Swine flu was the latest and biggest, although MRSA kills more people than AIDS in this country. Not all MRSA, of course, yeah. Most people forget that. It's a nasty disease. Some of it is coming from the pig farms. That's been documented. MRSA has been found in fresh pork in the store. Swine flu is the mixing bowl, because that's the virus, and that's the scariest part. And I think we really dodged the bullet. I mean, this season's flu was very mild by comparison. We were lucky. But it cost the world billions and billions of dollars, and people did die of this disease, and it was a huge disruption. And six of those eight viral components did evolve from a hog factory in North Carolina back in 1998. And for a decade, epidemiologists and people at the CDC were wondering where it was and what it was doing and when was it going to evolve again and jump back over to people or jump over to people. And that's what happened. Once a virus gets introduced into these populations, it can mutate very, very quickly. And it can get back out, usually through the workers. And one concern I have, and a lot of people have, for example, in Iowa, you will have a hog factory, and then maybe a quarter mile away downwind, you'll have a chicken factory, mm-hmm. and then you'll have another hog factory, and either just blowing particulate matter or birds that can transfer these things, or even rodents. If an avian virus was to evolve and somehow get carried over to the hog factory and get into the pigs, that's where the pigs become the mixing bowl, and that's the jumping point between avian and human. So now you have an avian porcine swine flu where maybe it would mutate to the point where the workers would become infected. They would bring it home to their families and communities, and then you have the start of something really serious that would make this swine flu season, you know, look nothing. So that's Rick's point.
But Rick's point and the other points here, I mean, are that this is kind of why they've all come together nationally. I mean, your characters meet
mm-hmm.
At this meeting
mm-hmm.
that takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And a likely place for a conservative Republican stand up. I love the way in one part of your book they say, someone says, we're not environmentalists, we're farmers. We can talk about this.
Correct. They're defending their communities.
Right.
These are conservative people.
That's important, I think, to keep the point out. I mean, so another interesting character in your book, my guess is he would have been one of your characters had your
Mr.
editor
Peterson.
Allowed it.
With all apologies to Chris, yes.
It was Chris Peterson.
Yeah, yeah. He's another amazing guy. He's sort of the political yin to Rick Doe's yang in a way.
Interesting way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they're similar in a lot. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same age and, you know, been through a lot in their lives. Chris is a pig farmer. At one point was forced out of the business like so many other small pig farmers were in the 90s when the large operations started coming in. He's president of the Iowa Farmers Union, which is a progressive sort of family farm. There's, I believe, one in every state. And very, very political. Been active in Democratic politics on the county level, at the precinct level, for years. And is somewhat of a kingmaker there. If you're a Democratic contender for the Iowa caucuses, you better go see Chris Peterson, you know, and visit and see his pigs. And I write quite a bit about the 2008 election and what was going on in Iowa. And it's really quite, I mean, I'm a political junkie, so for me this is one of my favorite parts of the book, but it's fascinating what happened there. And towards the end, you know, Edwards basically moved to Iowa and he was there for a year. And right before the caucuses, maybe people sensed something was going on. I don't know that he had troubles of his own, but he started to burn out. And
he had a few troubles going on that he didn't let us know about.
He
later.
Had troubles. Maybe people sensed it.
Right.
Hillary, who was expected to win in the last few weeks, got really cozy with the pork people. And that did not sit well way out in those rural precincts where Edwards had been doing so well. People turned away from Clinton big time. And all of a sudden, here's this guy, Barack Obama, from a farm state right next door, talking about CAFOs, making all these promises, saying he's going to fight agribusiness, he's going to take on the polluters, he's going to crack down with the EPA. He promised to hold a national rural summit within 100 days of office.
Hasn't happened, has it?
Not yet.
No.
But I think his first 100 days he can be forgiven for, but there's been several 100 days.
Yeah, right.
He should get around to it. Anyway, the point is Hillary turned off a lot of people just as Edwards started to tank and Obama was there. And he was saying all the right things in the rural precincts. And people who probably would not have even considered voting for Obama suddenly thought, I like this guy. And Chris was obviously involved with a lot of this. So the point is, and I say it in the book, I believe that it's because of the CAFO issue that Obama actually may have won Iowa. And if he had lost Iowa and if Hillary had gone on to win New Hampshire, I don't think he would be president today.
And he also won, as you pointed out, a lot of states that were very rural.
Correct. Yes, he did.
That are still on the edge.
Yes.
And partially won those states because of his stands against factory farming and for the small farmer.
Yep. And, I mean, again, Helen Reddow voted for Barack Obama. I think it was the first time she voted Democrat in her life. He spoke to a lot of these people, and his agenda was very, very good. And you can go to my website, and I'll be writing about this on Huffington Post, all the things that Obama promised, much more significant than a summit, to rein in some of the excesses of the factory farms, both on the pollution enforcement side of the EPA, but also on the economic structural side at the USDA, doing things in terms of the subsidies that the big companies get. Trying to level the playing field more, like I said, trying to break up these vertically integrated companies that control these animals from semen to cellophane, as we say in the book.
There's a yeah, I love that. You have a good way with words. Well, you're a writer. You should have a way with words.
Well, I can't take credit for that term.
You can't take credit for that one?
No.
But I so one of the things that happened between Chris Peterson and Barack Obama and the farmers and Obama was President Obama really played to the farmers in terms of what he was going to do to change the dynamic between industrial farmers, corporate farming, and the regular farmer, the regular farmer, the family farmers, some of whom are organic, most of whom are not, but they're sustainable farmers. They try to do things in a way that they've done for generations to keep the land healthy.
Correct.
And our food healthy. But something goes on here. There's a brick wall. Let me go back to the brick wall. Either there's a brick wall that Obama has gone up against and doesn't know how to get over, the brick wall that the community people have found that they're still fighting to get through, which is the power of the corporate farms, and how to get beyond that. Because you're talking, you know, this is something that's kind of dominating American agriculture.
Yes.
We produce cheap. We should produce inexpensive food and mass production that gets out so you can buy your chicken for $2 a pound or $1.50 for thighs or whatever it is that we buy, and we feed our people this way.
We do, and there's something to be said for that. Again, I mean, that is something that agribusiness has going for it, is that cheap price tag, but we forget the hidden costs. Obama, oh boy. First of all, he's been busy and distracted. I don't think anybody expected farm policy to be in the top three, you know, of what he was dealing with. But, you know, it's been a while now. He hit the reality of governing versus campaigning. He hit the reality of how powerful and how entrenched these major companies are, not just at the White House in K Street, but in the state houses, in the courthouses, in the county commissions. They're very powerful interests. But in researching this piece for Huffington Post, which I hope to get up very soon, I was actually surprised by how much they are doing at the EPA and at the USDA in line with his promises. Now, he hasn't kept all of them, and some he has blatantly gone back on, just broken, flat out broken. But in some areas, in terms of pollution control, even new rules here for the Chesapeake Bay for water emissions, new standards for organic farming, getting rid of some of the more onerous things that really hurt the small farmer and benefit the big farmer. They're in the process of rewriting all of those rules. Now, this is all done very quietly, not on purpose. It just doesn't make the papers.
Right.
It takes a long time, I didn't realize, to rules have to be proposed, and then they have to be reviewed, and then they have to be approved. And so the USDA secretary or the administrator of the EPA can't just wave a magic wand and change things overnight. But those things are in motion. I don't think people are aware of it.
So, but I get a sense also from your work that you, jaundice is not the right way to put it, but you look at this thing in a kind of through clear glasses in a pragmatic way. I mean, you kind of see the difficulty of changing the way we do agriculture. Because my question has always been, I'm curious to see your thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. My question has always been, can we feed America and can we have an agriculture that takes care of society and our food needs that's at least semi-affordable without destroying the environment mm-hmm. and bringing disease to us and make it affordable? I mean, can that transition really happen? Are corporate farms here to stay forever? Is that what we're stuck with and have to work with that? Or can the Chris Petersons of the world and the others really be the mainstay of agriculture in America?
Yeah. Nobody knows the answer to that question. I didn't attempt to
No, you didn't attempt to provide one. I'm just asking you the question.
No, I know. It's so complicated, and it gets emotional, and it gets vitriolic. Feeding the country is kind of job number one when you think of feeding and defending and protecting the health. I mean, I can't think of anything more important. So, we have to do it somehow. We did manage to do it for hundreds of years in a non-industrial way. Obviously, we have more people now, but we also have a lot of land in this country. I would never predict the future, but I agree with you in that I am kind of realistic about it. These things aren't going to go away anytime soon. They're certainly not going to go away on their own unless we have some major disaster like Rick predicted, in which case they might become obsolete overnight.
Right.
The other disaster that could happen is we run out of oil, because without fossil fuels, the CAFO system can't survive. It's so energy intensive, right down to producing the fertilizer to grow the corn to feed the animals. I don't believe in the long run it's sustainable. What I believe is that consumers have a choice, that we do have a free market economy, that in most industries, the market determines production. Mm-hmm. And here, production is basically telling the market what it's going to get. And I don't think that is the American way, quite frankly. And that's not a true capitalism. That's crony capitalism. That's not real capitalism. In real capitalism, it's actually very democratic. The buyer decides what product he or she wants to buy. But that assumes that the producer has equal access to that market. So the buyer could say, okay, I have pork chop A grown in a factory farm. It's $2 a pound. I have pork chop B grown out in a wonderful little pasture in Idaho, and it costs $3.50 a pound. Am I willing to spend that difference? If you educate people and you give them a choice, it's amazing what they will do to buy product B from Idaho or wherever. They may have to sacrifice something else. They may have to give up their premium cable. They may have to eat less meat. Now, if you take that pork chop and you slice it up and saute it with vegetables, you now turn it into four meals instead of one meal. And you can say, so nobody's saying stop eating meat. But my point of all this is I think we are, because demand is growing for sustainably raised food, in Brooklyn where I live, in New York City, the farmers markets are just overflowing. You can't get into the food co-ops. They're so popular. The restaurants now all boast about their locally sourced, sustainable everything. So the demand is there. People are willing to pay a premium for it. Now, we don't want to develop a two-tiered system where poor people have to eat mass-produced food.
No, right.
And other
exactly.
people get to eat the good stuff. But I do see a mixture, a more diversified thing. And that's where it comes back to both consumer behavior, educating yourselves and demanding if it's important to you. Now, there's a lot of people out there who don't care. I'm sure they would read my book and say, you know what? I got to feed my family. This doesn't affect me directly. I'm going to buy the cheap food. But I think if we have more mixture, more access to the market, more education, at least we can get more people into the field of agriculture, into sustainable farming.
Do you think, and very quickly, do you think all the things that they come up with, and we don't have time to get into it now, but the AWI Humane Standard and the things that this, when these, all your characters come together in a national conference mm-hmm. and they want to make a new world and do things in a different way, what do you think of their efforts? Is that growing?
It is growing. You talk about the Animal Welfare Approved label, which has a very strict criteria for raising these animals. Again, all you have to do is show people some pictures or, forgive me for plugging it, read the book. And if you're okay with that, you have every right to, I believe you have a right to go buy that product. But I think you're going to search out alternatives as well.
We've been talking about David Kirby. His book is Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment. Animal Factory, really a wonderful book, an easy read, and one that you all can wrestle with. And I think that those of us who are thinking about what the future of our world is, this is one of those books, David Kirby's Animal Factory. And David, it's really been a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Mark, it was a great discussion. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.